I do not think that many parents are aware of what's inside the game. In fact, in my presentation, I show many pictures from the inside the books just to show the images of this game. I mean, the gruesomeness of this game and the occult link to it.
Well, I know that when I did my message, and this has happened, I have letter after letter where people took the pieces. Now, there's sixes involved in the pieces of the game, but they'd take the pieces of the game, they would throw them in the incinerator or the fireplace, and screams would come out because there seemed to be some kind of spiritual forces inhabiting those pieces, and children would drop out of life. They didn't want to study anymore. What are the pieces?
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and together with Dr. Karen Stolzno, we examine stories about monsters and the facts behind them. In this episode, we'll be talking about a troubling time in American history, a period in the late 1970s, much of the 1980s, in which a substantial portion of the population was inundated with fearful stories about dark, satanic dangers lurking in the shadows right here in Everytown, USA. This period of history is known as the Satanic Panic, and it was no laughing matter. Strange stories were repeated in the pulpits of churches, whispered among parents at PTA meetings, and shared through viral social media of the 1980s, fax machine lore. People went to prison for allegations of satanic ritual abuse. Police were giving training seminars, alerting them to the dangers of satanic murders and kidnappings. And as scary as these allegations were, amazingly, there were no such dark cultists. It was a moral panic. We'll be touching on this topic again in the future because it figures heavily in some of the claims behind cattle mutilations, but in this episode we'll be talking about how it impacted one of my favorite hobbies, tabletop role-playing games. Our guest today is Professor Joseph Laycock. Joe is an assistant professor of religious studies at Texas State University in San Marcos, Texas. He has written extensively on topics of interest to Monster Talk listeners, such as vampires, and previously appeared on our episode discussing Slenderman and Tulpas. Today we'll be discussing themes from his latest book, Dangerous Games: What the Moral Panic Over Role-Playing Games Say About Play, Religion, and Imagined Worlds. But first, a word from me.
Monster Talk.
Hello, listener. How would you like to be on Monster Talk? I don't have time to interview everyone, but I'd like to do something interesting for episode 100 of the show, and I'd like your help. Here's all you need to do. 1. Decide what your favorite monster is. 2. Record yourself digitally using this format. My name is blank, and my favorite monster is blank. Obviously, don't use the word blank. Fill in your actual information there. And then 3. Save that file and email it to me, blake@monstertalk.org. And here's the important part. Put the words episode 100 in the email subject. That's all you have to do. Send me your name and your favorite monster as an audio file and put episode 100 in the subject. Thanks for helping us make episode 100 extra fun.
Monster Talk.
Thanks to all the people who have already sent me your audio. This is episode 95, so you still have a few weeks to get your contributions in. Now let's get on to our interview.
Okay. So first, Joe, I suspect that most of our listeners already know all about this, but to be thorough, when we're talking about role-playing games, what are we talking about? What are role-playing games?
Well, you know, role-playing games seem to be a sort of intuitive level of human behavior in that children will play with dolls, children will pretend to be their grown-ups and imitate things that they see their parents doing. So it's a sort of natural behavior, but fantasy role-playing games are something a little bit different that really began in the late 60s and 70s, and these were more sophisticated versions of war games, things like Gettysburg and Risk, games made by companies like Avalon Hill. And so in some senses, it's kind of like being a kid again where you're playing cops and robbers. But the rules are a lot more complicated, as anyone who's played these games probably knows. So they're very involved in creating realistic models of anything that can happen in the game. So this is where the big manuals and the funny-shaped dice come in that people have probably seen, even if they've never played a role-playing game before.
And you mentioned that a lot of these games first hit our culture in the 60s, but you talk about in the book that there's quite a history to role-playing games, and they really go back hundreds of years. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of these games?
Sure, and other people have done more detailed work on this than I have. John Peterson's book, Playing at the World, is a fantastic history of role-playing games. But for as long as there's been warfare, there have been games of warfare, things like chess. And after the scientific revolution in Prussia, the Prussian military said, well, what if we made a game that was really a simulation of warfare and was as realistic as we could make it? If we did that, then we could train our officers to make better tactical decisions on the battlefield. So the Prussians began making more and more complicated games involving moving pieces on a grid and making more and more rules for different types of situations, for artillery, for pontoons, for rough terrain, and this sort of thing. And eventually they got so complicated that they said, well, we should just have a veteran officer be the mediator. And the two players can attempt to do things, and the veteran officer will just say whether or not their tactics work. Then, during the Napoleonic Wars, a Prussian militia was able to defeat a professional French army, and that victory was attributed to the training using the war games. So then every modern military began making various forms of war games, including the U.S., and eventually there was a move to try and make a game that civilians could enjoy. And so this led to games like Stratego, and then the company Avalon Hill made Gettysburg, which was a really successful game. Americans, for the first time, could relive the Battle of Gettysburg in their playing at their kitchen table, and sometimes the South would win. And so by the 60s, there was a culture of people who would play these war games. And then slowly, kind of fantastic elements got to be introduced. People said, well, what if there had been a dragon present at this battle, right? How would that have played out? And so the games began to include more fantastic elements, and they began to focus on individual characters instead of whole armies. And they shifted from a zero-sum game where there's a winner and a loser to a game where there's lots of players with their own agendas, and there's no longer a stated goal or object to the game anymore. The game just sort of goes on, and you play it just for the pleasure instead of to win.
Wow, so it's really been a matter of art imitating life and life imitating art in the history.
Absolutely, and I think that's why these games are sociologically significant, is because the games do reflect reality, and then we think about reality differently after breaking reality down into a model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, first of all, let me just throw this out. I really enjoyed the book, and this is a topic that's really near and dear to my heart because I'm a gamer. but I've also I distinctly remember some of the things you're talking about culturally in the book, the sort of satanic panic period of time. We went to a summer camp, and I heard about some of the what really turns out to be urban legends about gaming and about Dungeons and Dragons in particular, and about rock bands and satanic influences. And so I just want to throw that out there that the people may be wondering, why are we talking about this on Monster Talk? There's really actually two reasons that this is a great topic for, I think, most Monster Talk fans, and that is that, on the one hand, there are monsters within the context of these games that are fascinating. And they come from just an amazing array of backgrounds, mythological and just made up for the game, you know, in particular. But there's also this other context where these games are framed in terms of being gateways to the occult, but not the occult like, you know, Wicca or, you know, people who see themselves as modern pagans, but an occult that, as near as I can tell, doesn't really exist. Almost like a fantasy occult. Is that overstating it?
No, that's not overstating it at all. The FBI, when they were investigating these claims of satanic cults, eventually wrote a report, and they said, when you guys say a cult, what you really mean is any religion that isn't your own, right? So there was a police training manual that was passed around in the 90s with a list of occult symbols. And literally, the Star of David from Judaism was an occult symbol. The crescent from Islam was an occult symbol. The yin-yang, the ankh, pretty much everything except for a cross was considered to be a symbol associated with dangerous cults. So, yeah, this is a really loaded term that just sort of means anything that we think is out there that is scary and bad. And it's a great way to get people jazzed up and ready to do things that maybe they wouldn't normally do if they feel there's an occult threat out there.
Yeah. So we have a lot of like sort of framing structural questions about, you know, getting the background on the gaming itself. But I just wanted to throw that out there for people who are wondering, why aren't we talking about this? Because there's at least two interesting layers of threat, if you will. So we'll get back to the role-playing questions, but I just wanted to go and put that out there at the beginning because there's some really dark and interesting things that happen, and I think this is going to be fun talking about it.
Yeah, well, Joe just mentioned police training, and I'd read the section in his book where he was talking about role-playing games that are used by governments and corporations and even healthcare professionals. So, Joe, could you tell us a little bit about how role-playing is used in those areas and by adults?
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of literature about how role-playing games are used really in any line of work where you have to make quick decisions, right? Because you can make those decisions in the context of the game where the consequences are reduced as a kind of simulation. And then hopefully when it's an actual emergency, you'll make better decisions. So I know that they have done things like constructed model Afghani villages so that soldiers on peacekeeping missions can practice interacting with people, pretending to be tribal elders and things like this. They've used role-playing games to do emergency preparedness in the events of flu outbreaks and things like this. So role-playing games is a great way to develop skills and kind of new ways of thinking about things. But the panic was specifically about fantasy role-playing games, role-playing games that involve magic and monsters and things that don't exist in the real world.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Well, yeah, so the way that D&D was described by these people, the people who were against it, makes it sound way more sinister and disturbing than the game really is. I think for our listeners, a really good example of this is the comedy routine by the Dead Alewives, which I'll put links to that in the show notes, which is very funny because it sort of frames it like, now we're going to take a deep look inside the satanic world of Dungeons & Dragons. And it's just people in the basement playing and eating Cheetos. So in your research, did you find any evidence that that the people who have this sort of framework, making Dungeons & Dragons or role-playing games the sort of target of moral outrage, have they ever even played or seen a game of Dungeons & Dragons?
Well, no. the short answer is no. And in some cases, they're clearly lying. So, I mean, one of the most outrageous things I found was this psychologist who told this story about this girl who is playing Dungeons & Dragons and she becomes addicted to it and she's playing every day. And then she is banished from her kingdom in the game. It's not really even clear what this means. So she buys a functional longsword at an antique store and kills herself by running it through her own stomach. And of course, there's no way of verifying this claim, and I'm trying to think about where this 14-year-old girl would get this sword and how she would manage to run it through her own stomach and so forth. And it's very clear this person is just making this up. The founders of BAD, Patricia Pulling, claimed that she met a group of gamers at the local college and played 40 hours a week with them for months. I don't think that's true either. She seems to have no understanding of the game and the writings that she would put out. And also, gamers don't play for 40 hours a week, not even the most dedicated gamer. The only incident where I think somebody actually played is William Deere. William Deere was a detective who was hired to track a missing college student that he believed had disappeared because of their involvement with D&D, which didn't turn out to be true. And he wrote a book about this called The Dungeon Master. And in that book, he describes, you know, wanting to learn more about the game, to understand the mind of this missing student, and approaches a random college student and says, if you meet me in my hotel room tonight and run a D&D game for me, I'll pay you $50. And then says 60 if it's a good game. I can't imagine what this student thought about that proposition, but showed up at the hotel room with a friend, and there's a description of the game, and the game is so kind of frustrating and banal that I think it really happened, and the character sheets are published in the book. But that's the only case where I think someone making these claims really had any idea of what they were talking about.
Yeah, that's a sad story. Do you know that led to the famous? I mean, it's almost legendary idea that people at universities were going into the steam tunnels and playing games. I mean, that comes up in so many gaming stories that I've heard. But it all starts right there with that case. Can you talk a little bit about what the reality of that was versus what the legend was?
Sure. So this was a student in 1979. His name was Dallas Egbert. He was allegedly a prodigy with sort of genius level IQ. He started college when he was only 16, but apparently had a lot of problems. He was epileptic. He was experimenting with drugs. He was gay, but not out at a time when this was much more stigmatized than it is today. He was involved in games of D&D on the campus. But apparently he had been told not to come back because they said you can't play while you're high and we think you're on drugs. So his involvement with D&D was actually fairly minimal. But he disappeared, and William Deere was this detective that had ended up getting involved with the case. And William Deere is an interesting figure. He's been accused of being sort of narcissistic or kind of a megalomaniac. He wrote a book more recently called O.J. Simpson is Innocent and I Can Prove It. And he also appeared on the Fox Alien Autopsy documentary, which some of your viewers may be familiar with. So he's kind of drawn to media sensation sort of cases. Anyways, Deere found a corkboard in his room and came to believe that this was some sort of clue to where Dallas Egbert had disappeared to. And sort of constructed this narrative in his own mind where Dallas Egbert either had lost touch with reality and believed he was living in a fantasy world, or else was some kind of evil genius and was now setting himself up as the dungeon master and luring the investigators into this kinds of game that he had created for them. What it turned out was that Dallas had actually gone into the steam tunnels under the college campus, had taken a lot of Quaaludes in an attempt to kill himself. It was an unsuccessful suicide attempt. He woke up, and then he decided to just run away. He went and lived with some acquaintances he had met through the gay community. So various people were willing to kind of put him up for a night, but nobody wanted him living with them permanently because of the nature of the situation. So a month later, he called his parents, and he had ended up in Louisiana and said, I'm ready to come home. So they sent William Deere to pick him up. So William Deere really had nothing to do with finding him. But in the month that he disappeared, William Deere had a press conference where he said, this was a kid. This all happened because of Dungeons and Dragons. He lost his ability to discern fantasy from reality. And so you had all these headlines saying, genius kid disappears in D&D cult and this sort of thing. And unfortunately, a year later, Dallas really did kill himself. And a contributing factor to that may have been that all these newspaper articles outed him as gay in the paper. So it really was a very tragic case. And then the story was adapted into the novel Mazes and Monsters, which was a parody of D&D, which eventually was adapted into the movie with Tom Hanks, which I think Tom Hanks is still a little embarrassed about. But folks with a Netflix account can go rent that. And this is sort of an adaptation of the scenario that William Deere was describing of a gamer who becomes delusional and loses base with reality.
You just stole my next question. I was going to ask you if the case was tied to the book and TV movie.
It absolutely is, although the author of that book played quite a lot of D&D and understood it. So she was not really aligned with the panic, in the sense that her take on things was not, this game is corrupting children, it's destroying society. Her take was, society is already harmful, and so a generation of teenagers who feel like they have no hope are taking refuge in this game. So she played that game quite a lot. She enjoyed playing a fighter character in the game, and so one of the female characters in the game is sort of, in the story, is sort of based on her and how she kind of found playing this warrior character empowering while she was playing D&D for her research.
So are there real world dangers to these games, do you think?
Absolutely not. No, I don't think so at all. There's some psychological literature out there on this, but I found a lot of cases where this is very therapeutic. So there's one famous case study of someone with crippling depression, but she has created a hero that's a player in one of these games, and that sometimes the way that she beats her depression is she thinks, well, I'm going to pretend I'm this hero, right? What would this hero do in this situation? I found another case where there was a teenager who had attempted suicide and was in treatment, and found a D&D group and played an evil character. And this is, you know, this is controversial, that in Dungeons & Dragons you can play an evil character. There's rules for that. But the therapist had a lot of progress with him, asking about, well, when you play this evil character, you know, why do you do the things that you do? And you know, it turned out that by doing these evil things within the context of the game, where it's not actually hurting anybody, he kind of worked through some of his personal issues that he had with his family and so forth in a healthy way. So the therapist actually wrote a paper about this and suggested that this can be an outlet that helps people to kind of think about things that are going on inside them that they couldn't otherwise express, right? And this is really what all art does, whether it's painting or fiction writing or role-playing games. It takes things inside you that you can't quite express and gives you an outlet for them.
Right, so it's kind of like the psychodramas used in satanic rituals as well by the Church of Satan.
Yeah, I think if you look at what the Church of Satan actually does,
right,
as opposed to the many, many claims about what they allegedly do, then yes,
yeah.
Right, there's a sort of catharsis,
yes,
and a sort of release of things that are not always socially acceptable.
So, in the book, you talk about moral entrepreneurs, and we're kind of leading into the satanic panic discussion here. But so how do you define a moral entrepreneur for our listeners?
So in sociology, there is a literature of what's called moral panics. And a moral panic is when a particular a cultural phenomenon, whether that's you know, sort of punk rock teenagers, or street gangs, or witchcraft, if we go further back, is seen as something that is a threat to society, something that has the potential to, if not destroy society, kind of ruin society, undermine its values, and so forth. And so, in a moral panic, certain people will step forward and become kind of the leaders of the panic. And these may be political leaders, they may be religious leaders, they may be you know, concerned parents, right? That was a big factor in the claims about Dungeons and Dragons, concerned parents. And they create what's called a folk devil. So a folk devil is sort of whatever is kind of out there that is the alleged threat to society. And usually it's something that's actually not really a threat, it's just new or it's misunderstood. And Stanley Cohen, who's a leading sociologist on this, wrote that the ideal folk devil is something that's actually very weak and can't fight back, right? So with the moral panic over D&D, right, most of the players were adolescents who really had no ability to resist if these claims were being made about them.
Do you think that it's still a folk devil today?
No, I don't. I've read some more recent literature where there's kind of a new generation of gamers, and they interview sort of the old guard, and they say things in the interview like, well, first of all, I'm not a Satanist. And these younger gamers are like, well, why would I assume you're a Satanist? Is that the thing? Right? So I think the stigma is now pretty much gone, but it does still come out here and there. Pat Robertson in 2013 on the 700 Club was still talking about how D&D has destroyed people's lives. Don Reimer, who is one of these police consultants that gives seminars on so-called occult crime. He died recently, but as recently as 2011 was reiterating that D&D leads to satanic crime. And then in the political sphere, there has still been a number of cases where politicians who play games like World of Warcraft have been attacked, and their opponents have tried to claim anyone who plays World of Warcraft or plays role-playing games is somehow evil or unfit for public office because they're mentally ill. But lately, those kinds of attacks have backfired.
Yeah, it was amusing to read about that because those people vote. Gamers vote, and they're online. They talk mm-hmm. to each other. It's like
that's right. I think the best case was one of the campaigners for John McCain compared Obama fans to nerds living in their parents' basements playing Dungeons and Dragons. And the gamers online took him to task for this, and he apologized, and he said, I didn't mean any slight to gamers, and you know this campaign is committed to increasing the strength, dexterity, constitution, intelligence, wisdom, and charisma of every American. So, even though he made fun of it, he clearly knew a lot about how these games work.
Yeah. So we're getting into the satanic panic a little bit here. How did the satanic panic begin to target D&D and role-playing games?
Well, the first half of the book is looking at the history of this panic, and I, because of my background in American religious history, I'm trying to connect the panic to bigger things that were going on in American culture at the time. So in the 1970s, when D&D was invented and published, there was a lot of fear about cults and about brainwashing, and the idea that your personality is actually very fragile and other things can come and give you a whole new personality. So if you look at books like The Dungeon Master talking about Dallas Egbert's disappearance, this fear of cults shapes the way that was interpreted, right? That this wasn't a game. This was about brainwashing. It was about mentally dominating people, rendering them insane. And then in the 80s, the sort of fear of cults about groups like that was directed at groups like the Hare Krishnas and the Moonies, the Children of God, these different groups that emerged in the 70s. That fear kind of shifted to the fear of satanic cults, and these satanic cults didn't actually exist at all. The Hare Krishnas at least really existed. You could point to one. But if you asked people, show me a satanic cult, they would say, well, they're real, but they're hidden, and they look just like ordinary people, so you never actually know who's a Satanist and who isn't. So that really began with Patricia Pulling, whose son committed suicide. And he had been an honors student in high school, and the honors class could play D&D as sort of a reward if they got all of their homework done. And the narrative that she eventually formed was that my son had been corrupted by this satanic game, and that he had been cursed in the game and was going to actually murder his family. That he had been given sort of a hypnotic command to do this, and that he killed himself so that he would not carry out his programming and murder other people. So in her own mind, she turned her son's suicide into a story of, well, my son actually martyred himself to save his family from this satanic game. So then Pulling formed an organization called Bothered About Dungeons and Dragons, which although it was small and was mostly consisted of very active, concerned parents, had a really tremendous impact and really a strong ability to kind of shape the culture and created a fear that these games are satanic or associated with occult crime that survived all the way to the present.
So Michael Stackpole wrote a thing called the Pullings Report, which was kind of a point-by-point counter comment to Pulling's approach to the whole thing. And he said he was going to be able to come and talk to us about that, but I haven't been able to get that scheduled, so I don't think it's going to make this episode. But besides that, what other kind of things eventually led to her not being – well, actually, didn't she died, didn't she? That what led to Pulling's sort of cultural impact against these role-playing games diminishing?
Yeah, I think the biggest one is the one that you pointed out, that she died of cancer in 1992, and I do think that she was doing a lot to sort of hold up this whole organization sort of single-handedly. Another factor that didn't help was what was called the Dungeons & Dragons defense. So a number of especially teenagers who committed violent crimes, either homicide or suicide, this was blamed on Dungeons and Dragons, right? Pulling kept what she called, or what was sometimes called, the trophy list, where every time there was an incident of violence involving a teenager that she felt could be linked to D&D, she would sort of add it to the list, right? So the first item on the list was her own son and Dallas Egbert's. And then the list would grow longer and longer from there. And mathematicians have written about how this is an example of how ordinary people don't understand statistics, right? Because if you looked at all the numbers of gamers and you looked at the number of people on this trophy list, that would actually imply that Dungeons & Dragons prevents suicide if you look at national rates of suicide. But most people don't think that way. They just think this is a really long list, so this has got to be a really dangerous game. Eventually people who were going to court for these crimes, people who had committed homicide or manslaughter or something like that, would say, it wasn't my fault. The game made me do it. And so Patricia Pulling would offer her services as an expert witness to come in on these cases. There were something like 30 different cases where people attempted the D&D defense. And as the decade wore on, they got increasingly ridiculous. So it went from cases of children or adolescents attacking their parents. And these are often cases involving abuse or other sort of complicating factors, to eventually people that, you know, robbed a gas station and shot the clerk in the gas station and said, well, I played D&D once. I thought that the clerk was an ogre, you know, this sort of thing. So the failure of that, I think, was another factor in what eventually caused these sorts of claims to look ridiculous.
When I was a kid, so I went to my doctor's office, and there was a little, you know, there were magazines and that sort of thing. But he also had a little a kiosk of gospel tracts. And there was a Jack Chick selection there, and I saw the famous Dark Dungeons comic book tract. And over time, at least in my perception, that seemed to be like a fairly important moment in this sort of anti-Dungeons & Dragons movement. What was the cultural impact of that tract? Did it have a bad effect? I mean, Jack Chick's stuff is pretty crazy. I don't know how else to put it. He makes it seem like that the world of Christianity is one where there's constantly superpowered miracles of happening on both sides of the aisle, if you will.
Yeah, so I have a chapter in the book where I look at these claims that the moral entrepreneurs, especially the ones like Jack Chick that were promoting these conspiracy theories, were effectively living in a kind of fantasy world, right? Because they were saying that behind the everyday world as we see it, there are these satanic conspiracies and there's witches and there's demons, and I'm the only one that has the ability to fight it. So they had really done the very thing that they were accusing gamers of doing, right? They had created a world in which they were heroes, in which they had this meaningful quest to destroy evil. But the difference was that for them, this was their reality, right? This was not a game that they could stop playing when they wanted to. And so most of the people making these claims were affiliated with Jack Chick. It kept coming back to Jack Chick and his publishing house. If you're interested in Jack Chick, there's a great book called Religion of Fear by Jason Bivens that talks about his life. But Jack Chick was very influenced when he learned that in China, Mao had successfully used comic books to spread communist ideology and thought that's what Christians ought to do. So he began making these little Chick tracks that everyone had seen. Of course, there was this famous one called Dark Dungeon. But a lot of the sort of the craziest, the most out there, the most paranoid claims makers about D&D were all connected to Jack Chick. So John Todd was this figure who claimed that he was part of this family of witches that secretly rules the world on behalf of the Rothschilds. Claimed that C.S. Lewis was secretly a Satanist, that Tolkien was secretly a Satanist, and he would go to churches and be this sort of whistleblower, and say, you know, I'm here to tell you about the demonic conspiracy theory. So John Todd ended up working with Jack Chick, and the preacher at the end of that comic actually looks like John Todd, and so I talk about this in the book.
He actually had that porn stash with.
Well, I mean, John Todd eventually went to jail for rape and was transferred into a mental institution where he finally died. So
wow.
when people say he was disturbed, he really was disturbed. He wasn't just quirky. Eric Schnobelin, who in his latest book talks about how he was a literal vampire because of his involvement with Satanism and literally sustained himself on nothing but human blood. Has also vehemently attacked D&D and was also published with Jack Chick. And Rebecca Browning, who for a while was a doctor and whose license to practice medicine was removed because of her sort of demonological claims that involved giving patients drugs that she should not have been giving. She also ended up publishing with Jack Chick. So it's just this sort of a very strange case of all these sort of profoundly paranoid, bizarre people and ending up finding a home with this one publishing company.
Is Chick still alive?
I don't know the answer to that. He's got to be very old if he's still alive. Yeah. He's famously reclusive, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Basically never done interviews. Or
I've looked at websites where they had alleged photos of him. That sort of thing.
Christian publications.
But the artwork in that comic is really good. It looks like an EC comic almost. I mean, and even the content's very similar to an EC comic, you know, like Crypt of Terror or a Vault of Horror or that sort of thing. But then it just goes off the rails if you compare, like, what happens inside the story, you know. Briefly for our listeners, I could link straight to Jack Chick's site the last time I checked.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and so people could read the comic for themselves. But I've had this conversation in real life with people where they've made those claims that there's supernatural elements. It's dice and paper, you know. I mean, it's an imaginary thing. There is no real magic in these games. It would be cool if there was. I mean, I would love to have some real magic powers, but it's just not like that. And it's fascinating to me how, with a straight face and a clear conscience, people can reframe what seems to me a benign activity into such a dark context.
Right. Well, the other thing that's so fascinating is that the creators of D&D were Christian, and they weren't a little bit Christian. They were pretty serious about being Christian. Gary Gygax, at least at one point in his life, was a Jehovah's Witness. And so these are not people that believed in magic or saw there being sort of any connection. And in one interview where Gary Gygax talks about this, he says, well, first of all, if I knew how to do magic, I wouldn't be making this dumb game, right? I would be ruling the world. And second of all, if you look at the actual spells, you know, one of the spells calls for legumes, right? That this is one of the things that you need to cast this spell. So obviously this is never going to amount to any kind of actual supernatural powers. But for people who've never played the game, those kinds of arguments could still be compelling.
They do call beans the magic fruit.
That's a good point.
Well, I think, as you're saying, it is a matter of ignorance and just not being exposed to these games. I grew up in Australia and that those games are played there, but I'm not a gamer now, wasn't then, and not knowing much about it. You certainly do hear a lot of these stories from people, and I think it can be pretty compelling if you don't understand the game itself and you think it's some kind of underground thing that's going on.
Yeah, another thing that I thought was really compelling is that both the claims makers and the people designing the games, they were both looking at the same world, you know, our world, and looking at the same elements, And so a lot of things like horror movies that were big in the 1970s were sort of adapted into Dungeons and Dragons and also adapted into claims about satanic conspiracy theories. So films like The Wicker Man and things like this tend to end up in both the conspiracy theories and in the games. And even if you look at the covers, if you look at the covers of D&D books from the 70s, and you look at the covers of books written by people like Rebecca Browning, they look very much the same. They both have swords and dragons and demons and stuff like that, even though one is about a role-playing game and one is about these are the last days and Satan's army is getting ready to come upon us. So in a strange way, both the conspiracy theories and the games were kind of what I call rival fantasies, right? They were both fantastic worlds, but one admitted it was a fantasy, the other one didn't.
Joe, in all of your research, did you uncover any evidence of anyone being led into occultism or satanic worship by the games?
No, certainly not Satanism. But there is a significant subgroup of people who both play fantasy role-playing games and who also practice, Wicca or paganism or some sort of magical practice. And we don't have any good statistical evidence about what percentage of people who play these games also are involved in kinds of a magical worldview outside of the game. But from some anecdotal evidence, people have said, well, I was interested in magic before I ever played these games, right? So there's no way to kind of determine it's important not to get correlation and causation confused. Mm-hmm. But I do think that for some of these games, especially in one chapter I talk about White Wolf games, White Wolf really tried to make a game that showed magic going on in the contemporary world in a way that was very realistic and plausible. And so I think for a certain percentage of players, they thought, well, if magic were real, it might be something like in this game. So there's never a case where people confuse the game with reality, but I do think there are cases where people begin to think about reality in a different way because of playing these games. And that applies to whether or not you think something like magic is possible, but it also applies to things like politics, how you think society works, what do you think would happen if you jumped off of a 20-foot wall instead of a 10-foot wall, and really anything in the world, right? These models that you have to make for it in the game affect the way that you think things will work in real life.
Personally, this doesn't really mean anything, but I don't know anybody personally who was, led to Satanism or anything like it from these games. I do know people who mentioned that, playing a game where the gods have stats and you can kill them, that did had an impact. Thinking about that, what is the source of this magical power? Why do some characters have it and some don't? That's not explicitly stated in the books, but in thinking about that, it led them to become, maybe better critical thinkers about that sort of thing in real life. I don't know. I find it fascinating that they saw this threat there. Or did they see a threat there? I mean, is the threat there, or is it that you get power culturally when you're calling out the threat? You know what I mean?
Well, I think there's a couple of things going on there. But my theory in thinking about this is that these fantasy games do function kind of like a religion, only in the sense that as a religion professor, I think religion is about people coming together and creating sort of a meaningful model of how the world works. So you see some of that going on in these games. And when gamers say things like, I'm religious about Dungeons and Dragons, I think that's what they mean. I don't think that they mean it's a religious identity in the sense that being a Christian or a Buddhist is a religious identity. But the flip side to that is you can come to see religion as a kind of fantasy role-playing game, right? You can come to see religion as a sort of game where everyone has a model of how the universe works, and everyone has roles, and they've just sort of been playing this game for thousands of years. And I think that thought occurred to some of these claims makers, and I think that a lot of the attack on Dungeons and Dragons was an attempt to push that back down. Right, my religion isn't a game; your game is an evil religion. And you mentioned books where the gods have stats and you can kill the gods. So there was this great book called Deities and Demigods that came out in the 70s and was very scary to people who claimed that this was an occult game. And they renamed the book Legends and Lore to kind of try and get them to back off, but that didn't really help. But one of these Christian claims makers said that in this book, Deities and Demigods, where there's stats for Odin and Zeus and so forth, that there's stats for Jesus, right? And Jesus has, I don't know, 50 hit points or something like this, right? And the thing about this is not true. There are no stats for Jesus or any biblical personage in any published role-playing game that I'm aware of. No one's ever done that. But you could do it. And what I think happened is that these Christians, that they had that thought, right? We could make stats for Jesus, and Jesus could, you know, be such and such level and have this many hit points and saving throws and so forth. But that thought was so anathema to them that instead of admitting the thought occurred to them, they projected that thought onto their opponents and claimed that in this book, Deities and Demigods, there's stats for Jesus. And of course, there wasn't, and the creators of that book were Christians, so they would never do something like that. So there's a few places like this where these sort of hidden fears seem to poke out, right? Where it seems like in attacking D&D, some of these people are desperately trying to shove something down that maybe they don't want to think about.
I can't imagine. I mean, well, truthfully, I never played in any campaign where we got high enough level to even consider those kind of activities, but. I always heard stories about people who went into God-killing campaigns and that sort of thing. I just can't imagine having – that seems kind of like a munchkin thing to do and that for, you know, just – I don't know.
Power gaming, yeah.
Right. It's a little too high level for my imagination. I can't even imagine what kind of treasure drops you get when you kill a god. So.
Right. And I should just add, as a religion professor, when I say that you can compare someone's religion to a role-playing game, I'm actually not trying to dismiss it or claim that religious people are delusional or childish or anything like that, right? But
no, it's structurally, it's got a similar way of – it's a mode of thinking, right?
Exactly. Looking at religions as social institutions, right, the way that people construct knowledge is very similar in both role-playing games and in bigger things like religions. Yeah.
Right. I don't know anyone – there's too much anecdotal stuff here because I've lived my life – for the most part, as friends or gamers and as a gamer. But I don't know anyone who has who considers this gaming a sacred activity. And perhaps that's one of the big differences, even though as a modality of thinking in game terms, you're acting out under these circumstances. You expect things to behave a certain way. You know, how would this character think? What are the impact? All these rules without that sacred context, it sort of breaks down as a religion, right? I believe. But I guess the question is, what constitutes a religion, right?
Right. And there's you know, the secret of religious studies as a discipline is there is no uniform definition of what religion actually is. And some religion scholars would even say there's no such thing as religion, right? It's better to talk about something as religious or certain things that are deemed religious and so forth. So I'm not ever claiming in the book that role-playing games are a religion. I'm just saying
– No. Yeah.
Let's compare them, and some interesting insights come out of the creative tension of that comparison.
I'm thinking in terms of this feels more like it could easily turn into a coffee table discussion instead of an interview if I'm not careful.
We've been talking about how a lot of criticism seems to come from religious groups, but you stated in the book that some attacks have been led by secular voices as well. So what are some of the secular concerns that have been revealed about these games?
Well, you know, this goes all the way back to the cult panic of the 70s. So there were always kind of two prongs of attack against the cults. So one prong was the religious one, which said these people are basically heretics, right? They're not Christian. They're going to hell and they're leading other people to hell. And the other prong was sort of the psychological or the medical prong, which said these people are engaged in brainwashing. These people claim they want to be in this cult, but they don't really because the leader has warped their mind by chanting or not giving them enough protein to eat or whatever it is. And so this weird alliance would form. So some of the secular claims made about the game had to do with brainwashing. That this was controlling people's minds. It was desensitizing them to violence. It was making them more likely to hurt themselves or to hurt others. And people like Patricia Pulling were actually got good at sort of changing, tailoring the message to their audience. So in what audience, if it was a secular audience, she would take on the persona of a psychologist and talk about the medical dangers of the game. And if it was a religious audience, she would just say, you know, demons come out of the game and possess you and put curses on you. So there's kind of two faces of the attack, and there's this strange sort of alliance that happens out of the satanic panic.
Mm-hmm. Very cunning.
A lot of the book you talk about sort of cultural frames of approaching these sort of topics. How in researching this from your field, how does that framing affect the way you approach the research? I mean,
right. So frame theory in sociology, this is the idea that we communicate with each other using symbols. And in fact, sociologists would say we sort of order our whole world kind of symbolically in terms of what things are, what things mean. Sociologists talk about what's called the symbolic order. Right? Why do I think of the thing I'm sitting on right now as a couch as opposed to sort of just a mass of wood and leather, right? It's because I have this symbolic conception of a couch. So symbols mean something in different contexts, right? Different sort of frames. And this is true even in the animal kingdom, right? So Gregory Bateson, who was a kind of a founder of frame analysis, said, if you watch monkeys, right, when they make certain facial expressions, this is aggression, right? And this symbolizes to other monkeys, right, I'm angry at you, you need to back away. But monkeys will also make those same facial expressions in the context of play. So when they're just at play, it actually doesn't mean you have to run away. It means let's wrestle, right? Let's play. And so humans are the same way, right? So something that in one context could be viewed as a threat or even an assault in a different context could be a prank or just kidding or something like this. And Bateson said there are even some forms of play that revolve around the question of, is this really play or isn't it, right? So things like fraternity hazing, right, that revolves around confusing the pledges about are you really doing something nasty to them or are they just sort of kidding? Is this just a joke? And so most of the time we can move seamlessly between different frames. So in role-playing games, Gary Allen Fine, who's a sociologist who first applied frame theory to role-playing games, says there's three frames. There's the one frame of we're all sitting around a table holding these funny dice and we're playing a game. There's frame two, which is the mechanics of the game, right? So how many the stats, the ability scores, the numbers. And then frame three is the actual story itself. And this sounds very confusing, but most of the time, if you watch players, they can seamlessly move between these three frames without any difficulties. And occasionally confusions arise where it's not really clear what's happening in the game or communication breaks down or something like this. But there are occasionally areas where you can switch frames and not be aware of it. So Bateson said that a schizophrenic is someone who is no longer able to communicate with everybody else because they're confused about what frame they are in. And so this kind of sets up my analysis for the whole book. Is this is the attacks on D&D are really a fight about can people kind of create their own discrete frames of meaning? Can they create their own sort of worlds of imagination, what in psychological literature is called paracosms, right? Because the claim of these moral entrepreneurs is, no, that's not a paracosm. That's not going on in your imagination. That's real magic. Those are real demons and so forth. So in making that move, they're sort of trying to drag the magic and the monsters out of this frame of imagination and say it's all real. So this is a major theme of the book, is how do we get good at negotiating these different frames of meaning without getting confused?
So speaking – and maybe I'm going to get confused trying to ask this question, so I apologize if I do. In the context of the satanic panic, you talk about people being afraid of cults. But the cults that they're afraid of, as you've already mentioned, are not the real cults. So there are real cults like the Moonies and the Heaven's Gate cults, and I think they have a real potential threat for some of the people who get involved in them, I think. But at the same time, there's this big, broad urban legend folkloric type cult, this which really is almost like an existential threat in that when you dig into it, you can't find it. But how do you differentiate within your field? So this is why I'm saying it's kind of a meta question. Like within your field work, if you're studying the concept of a cult that doesn't have any factual reality compared to an actual cult, which you could actually see real members and see their rules and behaviors, whatever. How is that studied, or how are they different in the way that they're approached?
Yeah, okay. So I'm glad you asked this. So in religious studies, we generally don't ever call anybody a cult, right? because this is such a loaded term. When you call a group, when you say that's not a religion, that's a cult. If you're talking about an actual group, right? So I say Mormons aren't a religion, they're a cult, which was a claim that was made back when Mitt Romney was in the Republican primaries. What that really is doing is it's putting a bunch of baggage in there implicitly, kind of subliminally, saying this is an evil group, these people aren't here by choice, they've been brainwashed, they're following a charismatic leader, and all this sort of thing. So if I'm talking about an actual group, we may call them new religious movements, or something like this. But generally in religious studies, we don't make a distinction between cults and religions, right? Groups like the Hare Krishnas, the Moonies, the Mormons, right? These are all real religions. And a lot of damage can happen if we try to dehumanize those people by calling them cults. On the other hand, if we're talking about a national panic over cults, right, we kind of have to use that term because they don't mean any groups in particular. They just mean this concept of cults. And then when you get to the satanic panic, right, these are really conspiracy theories. And there's always been conspiracy theories about groups that either don't exist at all or exist but are actually very powerless, right? So this would be the Illuminati's, this would be the Jews. In ancient times, this would have been Christians. And there's a great book by David Frankfurter called Evil Incarnate, which shows that basically the claims in these conspiracy theories are basically the same claims going to the times of the Roman Empire all the way up to the present with claims about a satanic ritual abuse. It's always there's these people, they're functionally invisible. You can't ever see them, but they're all around us. And their values are diametrically opposed to ours. And we help children, but they murder children. And, we don't have sex with our mothers, but they practice incest, right? And basically everything in these that these evil people do is sort of upside down. So there's a long literature about that and why at certain periods in history, people are maybe more likely to believe conspiracy theories.
You know, I guess it's a case of the gods of one religion are the demons of another.
Well, if we're talking about actual religious movements, then yes, it is. But again, if we're talking about Satanism, right, no one actually does these things. There isn't this actual group that goes and ritually tortures children for no reason, right? These things just don't go on. But for some people, I think the belief that this does happen kind of helps to support their view of how the world works, right? That in a weird way, it's oddly comforting to think that all the terrible things that happen in the world are not the function. They're not just circumstance. They're not because of complex situations we don't have control over. It's all being done by those Satanists, right? So we actually do have a lot of control over these problems if we can just root out the Satanists, right? Instead of having a lot of problems, you just have one. And it's actually something that a conspiracy theorist would say, I know a lot about.
Yeah.
So it's oddly comforting.
What actually ended the satanic panic, or is it over?
It's not over. I think what ended it was law enforcement and the media got a lot more savvy about these kinds of claims. But the general public still believes in this. There was a study very recently that said if you're on trial and the prosecutor says anything at all about Satanism, all right, this has an amazing power to sway juries, right? If they just hear a speculation that you might be a Satanist. I can't say much about this, but I'm actually an expert witness in a death penalty case right now, dating back to the Satanic Panic. So this is still very much something that's out there and that threatens to come back all the time. And what someone like David Frankfurter would say is that we're probably hardwired to think this way. There are psychological reasons that make us inclined to believe that there are evil conspiracies out there trying to hurt us for no apparent reason.
Mm-hmm. I think I've mentioned it before on the show, but there is a sort of a bias in law enforcement. If you had occult research books in your house and a crime was committed, it would become a factor. Like the police would say, oh, they had occult books. But nobody, and they would call it, they might call it a satanic crime or an occult crime, but nobody says, oh, we found a Bible. It was a Christian crime. That never happens.
Right. And the weird paradox of this is the investigators themselves always have all these books on the occult and are always fans of horror movies and are always preoccupied with fantasy. But they were the ones who accused first. So they're sort of above suspicion.
It's a different kind of frame.
Right, but exactly, it's a different frame. But anyone who has those same interests, who is not an accuser, becomes the accused and is vulnerable to those kinds of accusations.
We're really out of time now, Joe, and I hate it because we could just keep talking about this. This is a topic I love, and the book is fascinating, mm-hmm. and I think our listeners are really going to enjoy it. So we'll put a link to it in the show notes. But before we go, I know we've already asked you before what your favorite monster is, but let me ask you a different question. What's your favorite Dungeons & Dragons monster?
Wow. You know, I think my favorite Dungeons & Dragons monster is the Tarrasque. The Tarrasque in the Monster Manual is one of the most powerful monsters in the world, if not the universe. But I believe – you should do a podcast on this. I believe it actually comes from a French legend where a saint or something puts the Tarrasque to sleep and then the villagers beat it to death with clubs. So when they put in the Monster Manual, they made a lot of tweaks and power buffs on it.
That's funny. I think I'm still fond of the Land Shark.
The Boulet, the Land Shark. Yeah. I know that too.
Sounds like another show.
Yeah, I think so. We could probably do an entire episode just on the Monster Manual. There's so many fun things in there. And from so many different backgrounds. I can't imagine. So Gary Gygax gets, I guess, credit for writing the Monster Manual, but it has so many different influences. It's just such a potpourri of monster amazing things in there. So
who puts that together then?
What's that?
Who puts that together then?
Well, the Monster Manual comes with Dungeons & Dragons. It's one of the core books.
Okay.
So you had the Monster Manual and the Player's Handbook and then the Dungeon Master's Guide. Yeah. And if you have those three books and some paper and dice and some friends and some pizza and some orange Faygo, you can really have fun.
Sounds very satanic.
Oh, it's ridiculous. Thank you so much, Joe, for spending some time with us. And I really appreciate you coming back and talking with us again.
Yeah, thank you, Joe. I believe congratulations are in order as well. You just got engaged recently.
I sure did, yeah. And my partner, Natasha, who was here on the Slenderman podcast, said yes. So
awesome.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Well,
yeah.
Hopefully it's really her and not just a tulpa.
Seriously. Her diamond ring is just a tulpa, but don't
Well, that is great news. Congratulations indeed.
Monster Talk.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. You just heard Professor Joseph Laycock discussing the Satanic Panic and its impact on role-playing games. Joe's new book is Dangerous Games, and there's a link to his book in our show notes at monstertalk.org. If you decide to buy a copy of any of the books on Monster Talk, if you use the link in our show notes, a tiny portion of the proceeds will go to support the website. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The opinions expressed on this show are those of the host, the guest, and a shadowy cabal of puppet masters who control us with polyhedral dice, pizza, and the best of intentions. These opinions do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. Thanks again to the kind people who donate to Monster Talk via the website. Your patronage is much appreciated. Special thanks to David Cube and the amazingly supportive D.R. Crane. I've done a couple of contributions to the Skeptoid podcast, which uses a very different format and has far fewer puns, but which you might enjoy checking out. And I've been working on some ghost photography research, which may be part of a future episode, but which can be read about at Skeptic.com's Insight blog. I hope you'll give my articles a read and share them if you like them. I'm especially excited about the research I'm doing right now on the famous backseat ghost, which allegedly shows the image of a ghostly mother-in-law in the backseat of a car in 1959. More on that in the near future. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening.
Did you know that you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app, currently compatible with iOS, Android, PC, Mac, Kindle Fire, Kindle Fire HD, and BlackBerry Playbook. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more, and download more of your favorite Skeptic content.
I'm going to do a lot of editing on this episode. Sorry, Joe.
You were speaking in tongues there.
Yeah, exactly.